Hello, everybody. Good afternoon, just in New York. And as I look over the horizon to make sure there's no signs of a nuclear blast coming from Ukraine, we're concentrating on a crisis closer to hand. Up in Ottawa, there are rumors that the bear might actually start growling, that the police might, after several weeks, take action against the people who have hogtied Ottawa for several weeks. In between causing tremendous damage to Canada's reputation and institutions, I think many people would say. But we have our guests here who are going to tell us all about this. So let's get the state on the ground, because Tim Abre, you have done several columns for the Ottawa Citizen and others explaining just what the occupation has felt like on the ground. And it's difficult for these terms, because a lot of people on the left think occupation, good. Protest, good. Demonstration, good. Police defiance, good. Civil disobedience, good. And then you find out the people you don't like are doing it, and it gets down to the root of what it's all about. So you've been there, you've looked at it. What is happening in Ottawa today? Are there any signs of the logjam breaking?
Minimal signs, but absolutely there's been movement over the last 24 hours. There have been notices passed out in the downtown of the city. I live just a few blocks from ground zero of this conflict. There have been quite a few notices to surrounding businesses to keep things quiet today and keep people out of the neighborhood as much as possible. There's been an influx of law enforcement into the area this morning. So far, their main job has been passing out notices and ensuring people are aware that enforcement is impending. But so far, we haven't seen anything much beyond that. But it's clear that it is clear that there is an advancement in enforcement happening, even just with the presence. Police presence has not been a huge thing in this thing so far. There have been instances where there have been clusters of police for specific incidents. But for the most part, police have been keeping a fairly low profile on the periphery of this, trying to keep things cordial and conversational. But there has been very little in the way of enforcement of even basic parking bylaws, let alone enforcement of laws under, you know, the Highway Traffic Act, or God forbid, the criminal code. So it's, we're hopeful that something is going to happen soon, but it looks like there's a slow buildup towards that.
Well, the obvious contrast for people is that if a convoy of indigenous peoples from the oil sand territories had moved on Ottawa like this one, would they have got to Ottawa? Would there be a truck left standing? And would any of them be left unhandcuffed by now?
Well, that's a very good question that a lot of us are asking. And I think that there's a pretty strong consensus amongst many folks, commentators, that in fact, it would have been a very different reaction. In fact, it has been a very different reaction. We've already seen that. We saw it with the G20 in Toronto, eight years ago. We've seen it with multiple protests by Indigenous people, land defenders right now in BC, for example, where the RCMP have come in several times. We've seen it in homeless encampments as well, where they try to build cabins, you know, they're torn down. When these folks build a shelter and put up hot tubs and stages and those sorts of activities, it's fine. I think in particular, what really got people's attention was when there wasn't a forceful response to the border blockades. There was a piece of legislation called the Critical Infrastructure Defense Act that was, in essence, created to manage Indigenous conflicts in the moment, that has not been invoked against folks, even at the borders, where obviously infrastructure was being impeded and seriously and negatively affected. So the double standard is very visible and very blatant.
So we're fortunate the truckers didn't try to turn off a pipeline.
Yeah. Or that they were, predominantly white men.
Yes, I suppose that would help. They did milk the one Sikh for all his turban was worth, I noticed in the pictures. But in general, yes, they are of a certain pale complexion. I can't complain. I am myself. But I do notice when I'm surrounded by them, very dangerous people here in New York. So, Tim, do you want to come in on this?
Yeah, no, I think that what Dr. Perry is saying is critically important, that there is absolutely a complete disconnect between the way that this is being handled and the way that conflicts have been handled previously. And it's easy for people to start bringing up the most dramatic examples and putting them at odds with one another and conflating the problems that are already difficult to sort out. But I think that the easiest comparison you can make is a protest that occurred in the last year in Ottawa itself. It was a group of protesters who occupied one intersection of the downtown for not quite 36 hours, and they were quickly removed and arrested by police. And they were protesting police action itself. They were protesting the manner in which police had handled a particular incident in the downtown of Ottawa that involved violence against a BIPOC person. And the protest was well understood, the incident was well understood, but there was zero patience for it. And that protest was, in fact, truly peaceful. I think one of the things that is absolutely gut-wrenching for those of us who are living in the middle of this is the continued insistence of journalistic outlets, particularly internationally, to portray this as a peaceful protest. It is the furthest thing from a peaceful protest. People in downtown, I myself was assaulted in the early days of this for no reason, completely unprovoked and doing nothing more than walking through a park that happens to be adjacent to my daughter's high school. This is not a peaceful protest. Is it an all-out war where people are, you know, brandishing guns? No, it isn't. But the intimidation has been very real. The incidences of assault have been very real. Attempted arson, stalking, threats of violence against women, defecating on the front porches of LGBTQ people's homes. This is not a peaceful protest. And there are reasons why it is alarming to those of us who've paid attention to these things over the years that law enforcement has not stepped things up sooner. And it's because of this atmosphere. We live in the nation's capital. Those who live in nation's capitals around the world understand that those of us who live in nation's capitals are extremely familiar with protest. We see them constantly. We see them all the time. There are more protests in Ottawa in the summer than there are music festivals, and we have a lot of those. But what's different is that this one has a layer of intimidation that is involving the citizen population. This is not simply a protest against power. People are being directly assaulted simply for their clothing choices, their fashion choices, the color of their skin, and whether or not they happen to be wearing an N95 mask. These are not things that usually are attendant to legitimate political protest. At least
perhaps
not
we
in
should
Ottawa.
Explain to people less acquainted with Canadian politics. Ottawa is not a separate federal district like the District of Columbia, is it? It's the capital, but it comes under the Ontario provincial authorities for policing. True or false?
True. It's complicated.
Okay. It's just trying to explain also the answer to people. Because, you know, in DC, you had this point where the Capitol police force had obviously been well and truly ideologically infiltrated, at least, and then was by the federal government and was clearly taking a soft line under orders. But then the DC police had no dog in the fight officially. But here it's the Ottawa police forces first up. What role does the Royal Canadian Mounted Police play? When do they, aren't they supposed to come riding across the horizon like this sort of blue coat, a red coated version of the 7th Cavalry?
Well, it is complicated because there is also parliamentary police service of a sort. Meant to defend Parliament itself. Then we have the Ottawa Police. Then we have the Ontario Provincial Police. Then we have the RCMP. And I think this was the difficulty is that each level was saying, you know, outside of Ottawa, we're saying this is in our jurisdiction. You need to deal with it yourself. And so we're very slow. Now, having said that, there were Ottawa did call on some of the other municipal police forces. Toronto sent some officers. I think I don't know if early on, but right now I think Gatineau police across the border in Quebec, in fact, that have come to rally and support. So, but all of that
rally in support of whom? We have to check.
In support of Ottawa police.
And who are the Ottawa police supporting?
Well, that's the other question, isn't it? but that has been very slow to happen. That is to to sort of expand the levels and numbers of officers that have been on the street. Early on, maybe a week or so ago, a little longer than that, Chief Slowly asked for, 1,600 additional officers, 1,800 additional officers. And, the response was, well, you need to justify why you need more. Why can't you control this crowd? And, fell on deaf ears, I think.
That's shades of January the 6th as well,
absolutely. Yeah.
Standing in the middle of the ruins of the Capitol saying, why do you need more people?
Yeah, we have a large number of journalistic wags in this town who have frequently referred to this as January 6th in slow motion. I think that's not an inaccurate description, that there is the same level of animosity towards the governing power. There is the same level of confusion about the role of and function of institutions. But there is a very slow burn on what could best be described as physical animosity, simply occupying space and intimidating those who are attempting to take it away from you rather than attempting to actually seize parliamentary buildings or seize offices of power. They're doing it through the slow motion version of intimidating the populace and getting as much constant regular media attention as they possibly can.
It's a bit like the frog in the cooking pot, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I'd argue
the temperature gradually and people won't notice when they do something really drastic.
I think that's a really interesting and relevant point, particularly in the context of Canada. I think Dr. Perry will be able to speak more to this, but I want to highlight the point that this political undercurrent of essentially white rural discontent has been a factor in Canadian politics for quite some time. The difference is that it is beginning to get traction in a more broad populist way that it did not previously. We could have hours of discussion about the role of social media, the leveraging of those sites, the amplification through foreign interference or even domestic political interference. There's all kinds of ways of looking at this, but the bottom line is this has always been an undercurrent in our politics. It is just very much in the ascendancy at the moment, and people are paying attention, and there is a willingness for people to express their discontents through this particular mode in a way that would have previously have been seen as deeply un-Canadian. And it's interesting to see that people are willing to take this route.
You're absolutely right. This is part of a...
Go.
A longer trajectory that's been, it really has been simmering for some time. We completed our first study of the far right in 2015. It was really the first comprehensive examination of the movement in the Canadian context, academic exploration. And we identified conservatively just over 100 active groups at the time. But in our sort of updated study now, currently ongoing, we've identified year and a half or so, over 300 active groups. Now it's a moving target because they morph and grow and change their name and become something different. So it's really hard to track, but nonetheless, it is a movement that has become more visible, more vocal, qualitative shifts and quantitative shifts as well. What's really interesting here is what we're seeing is prior to COVID, a lot of the energy was devoted against the threat of Islam, the threat of immigration and non-white immigration in particular, and some anti-statism to the extent that, the state is responsible for those patterns. And then at the beginning of COVID, that sort of shifted subtly to anti-Asian and in particular anti-Semitic sentiments because this was a Jewish hoax or it was a Jewish conspiracy. And now by the time we come to the end of COVID, it really is about the tyrannical state and state overreach around public health measures. So it is something that has been there and it's been morphing, it's been changing shape and focus over time. And this particular convoy came at a time when I think we're all done with COVID. As someone said yesterday, we're done with COVID. COVID's not done with us. And I think that is the risk that, yeah, we're going to remove these restrictions in the next couple of weeks. And then at the April, we're going to be back into, the same situation. So this will continue to be a flashpoint for anxiety and anger and hostility and anomie. That's what we're in. We're in a state of anomie, complete normlessness. We don't know what the rules are. Where can we go to eat? Can we go out to eat? Can we go to a movie? How many people can come? Can I invite for dinner?
We have a garden party in the Prime Minister's backyard?
Of course we can.
Yeah. These questions are universal.
Yeah. So COVID has really provided the space for a whole array of grievances to come together, and they've been packaged very nicely by the far right, who are very adept at doing that, at exploiting populist concerns and providing easy answers and conspiratorial answers quite often as well.
This is almost Bolshevik revolutionary precision in terms of stirring things up, I think. The analogy is apt as well. I think, there are small groups of people who want to create chaos and derive advantage from it. In particular, maybe you can explain again, I'm sure you wouldn't even try explaining to the so-called truckers, but what they are asking for an end to the vaccine mandates and the mask mandates. The federal government can't do that. I mean, this is an international agreement with the US, which is enforcing no masks, enforcing masks and vaccination on the truckers. It's not the Canadian government, is it? They're going to stay there until the Canadian government does something it's not allowed to do, and certainly Trudeau's not allowed to do, because it would have to go to the Parliament if it was to get it passed, I presume.
Well, I mean, that's the irony in terms of, the starting point for this, which was the restrictions on crossing the border if you're not vaccinated. That was negotiated by both sides. Trudeau could, the federal government could repeal that, but they won't. And why bother? Because Biden's not going to repeal it on the other side. But it's become more than just that. It's become an issue around all of the mandates, all of the restrictions we have, which are not federal responsibilities. Health is a provincial responsibility. So it's the provincial governments that have imposed these. And so what we're seeing is, two or three provinces that are quite happy to accede to those demands because they've been resistant to impose these restrictions in the first place. So that's troubling to me now that they, will be seen to be giving them power by repealing the mandates that are in place. Now, some of that was planned prior in terms of what the deadlines were, what the dates were, but they're going to claim responsibility for that.
But I mean, Canada's fatality rate is far lower than the United States. And one of the reasons for that is you very cleverly kept the idiots out at the border. True or false?
Well, we have our own chair, thank you very much.
I know, you don't have to import them, but you stopped importing. No.
we have a bumper crop of our own. But but I think that there is something to what you're saying. But I think that that's the irony of this situation. Is that Canada, for the most part, again, Canada is very difficult to lump into one category for the reasons that Dr. Perry just itemized. That the jurisdictional issues in Canada are, in some ways, it depends on what you're talking about, but in some ways they are much more profound and serious than they are in the United States. And so what you've got is a situation where the bulk of public health measures are dictated by provinces individually. And so what is ironic about this is that the bulk of Canadian provinces are governed by right-wing parties at the moment. So you've got, in Ontario, for example, you've got a very populist-oriented conservative premier of the province. He does not make a good target if your fundamental issues are with so-called liberal policies. And so there's no question that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is a target of opportunity. He is somebody who is a great proxy for all the frustrations of the people who are gathering on the Hill. Some of them have been asked directly, why aren't you protesting more strenuously at legislatures provincially, because they're the ones who can actually do something about most of the mandates you're complaining about. And the answer is just very clear that, you know, well, doesn't the federal government have mandates? Well, then great, we're here. But the bottom line is that affects very few people in the scheme of things. But what it does do is draw a national focus to the issue. It doesn't allow it to be atomized, broken down into individual constituent parts, and marginalized. So there is no question that there is sophistication in the strategy in terms of gathering here, drawing attention here, building international attention here, creating a single narrative about mandates across the country. But the bottom line is, it is not about that. I mean, I wrote a piece last week about exactly this. We took, a friend of mine and I took some time to sit down and actually listen from the comfort of our own homes via an online forum to talk to people who were participating in the convoy. And we spent 2 hours listening to them and talking to them, and residents took part as well. And what's clear is that the complaints are not of the technical nature that we tend to be deeply affectionate of in the news media, right? It is not so simple and linear. These are people who are complaining about basically that they don't like being restricted in any way, and they don't like the way things are changing. And what they really want is just to be left alone to live life the way they wish to live. And they are venting their frustrations on a population and on governance structures that don't agree with that approach. And so what we've got here is a much more fundamental political disagreement about the manner in which a country should operate and the manner in which politics should dictate the rules by which we live. And I think that we gloss over that at our risk. We gloss over that. If we do, we're putting ourselves in jeopardy of really seriously underestimating the conversation that's happening underneath.
And this is where the tough decisions are made, because we support the right to protest in general, don't we? We support, you know, even direct action. You know, people in London, people occupy railway stations to protest climate. And as long as it doesn't take too long, people are prepared to tolerate it up to a point. But to inconvenience the general public for a long period, for an end that is completely unachievable, really makes you suspect there's another sort of twisty agenda behind it. And QAnon, there was big, and there was other weird groups were big in Washington. Any sign of them here?
I just want to check the language for a second, because this is a good example, right? Where you're saying inconveniencing the citizen population. It's far beyond.
It's British. It's British understanding.
No. I'm not taking you to task, Ian. I'm taking the narrative to task, because that is
terrorized and not inconvenienced. How's that?
Yeah, and I think the intimidation is really important, because this is a brand of politics that has been not uncommon at all in democracies over the course of democracy's rise over the last 300 years. You know, the use of physical force and intimidation was a commonplace thing up to 100 years ago in our politics. And it slowly has been filtered out into more acceptable means of protest. And I think that we neglect noticing that physical intimidation and those sorts of tactics are being allowed to creep back in and are continuously being labeled as part of the acceptable manner of protesting. And I think we have to note that, and we have to be careful not to allow that to be reintroduced, because the second we do, we are accepting arguments that might is right. And I don't think that that's particularly helpful to democratic dialogue.
Yeah, and you're right, because that's also the narrative that that politicians and law enforcement have been using as well. Excuse me, that this is legitimate protest. Everyone has that right. And yeah, you have that right to peaceful assembly and to promote your position, whatever it might be. It's when it crosses that line, as you say, you know, it didn't take very long for this to turn into something that was not peaceful. It was, you know, very quickly descended into the kinds of behaviors you're talking about. I mean, we have hundreds of hate crime charges, hundreds of hate crime complaints. What will happen with them is, you know, that's for another panel. So this was, not that, I think, from many people's perspectives. We look at public opinion poll, for example, the dwindling support, in fact, and sympathy that the movement is getting because it has devolved into chaos, essentially, and to violence as well. And that was, I think, underscored by what we saw at Coots at the border, where elements of that particular protest were heavily armed. And this was something that slowly was complaining or was fearful of from the outset in Ottawa, that there would be armed protesters there as well.
Well, Tim, you were witness in one of your recent columns to a form of citizen action. I'm surprised the police didn't go into the citizens of an area, blocked the convoy going through. The police didn't stop them from obstruction.
No, interestingly, but for the same reasons they were citing that they weren't doing anything about the main occupation downtown, just as insufficient resources and unclear direction. It's very interesting when you ask the local police as an entity.
Could you take it back a minute and explain to people what happened in the incident?
Oh, sorry. Yes, absolutely. Of course. See, this is how immersed in it I am. I just assume you're all paying attention. In typical Canadian fashion, a group of people in a neighborhood in the south central part of Ottawa, just south of the downtown, had posted in their dog walking group of all places on Facebook that they understood that reinforcements to the convoy would be coming into town on Sunday and that they really weren't happy about that. And maybe they should do something about trying to stop that. And they happen to be in a neighborhood that's at a crucial intersection. So Ottawa is bounded on a couple of sides by rivers. And so getting into the downtown requires you to either cross those rivers or not. And so there are some key bridges where you can jam things up if you'd like to. And so that's what they did, is they went and stood in the middle of an intersection when trucks approached bedecked in their decals and slogans and flags, made them very clearly a part of the convoy, or at least sympathetic to it. And they stood in the middle of the intersection and prevented them from going. And they held a large group of these largely pickup trucks hostage for the better part of an entire day. From 8 o'clock in the morning right through until about 6 p.m. in the evening, they held them at this intersection and they worked to negotiate with those truck occupants to negotiate their departure in a way that the police had not previously been willing to do, that they'd let them go if was basically the bottom line. And by the time we hit 6 o'clock, there were northwards of 300 people in that intersection holding those trucks. It had grown from the original 25. And it was a very clear case of extremely determined local citizen action that had no coordinating body whatsoever other than a dog walker's Facebook group. So I think it just gives you an indication of how fed up people in the city really are with what's going on, that they were willing to put themselves in the line of danger. And these were people who don't even live on the edge of the occupation zone. These are people who are living in a suburban area of Ottawa, who have just had it for their fellow citizens. And so they took a stand.
Dog walkers of the world unite. You have nothing to lose but your trucks.
We've seen similar reactions in other communities as well, where there have been weekend protests. So we saw it in Kingston last weekend, and we saw it in Edmonton on the weekend as well. But what's been interesting in those particular cities was, if you watch the images, law enforcement were facing the counter protesters and not the protesters. They were trying to push the counter protesters back. And in fact, in Edmonton, one of the shots, captured law enforcement threatening to invoke the Critical Infrastructure Act against the counter protesters, not the.
Now that's what I'd be looking for. I mean, because this really shows. This is a recurring thread through many of these protests, is the the ideological profusion of the truckers, protesters. They're not truckers and they're not protesters, they're saboteurs or whatever, but they're I'm losing my objectivity here, but these people's actions are not intended to achieve the aim that they're shouting, because it's impossible.
Yeah. Well, it was inevitable, I think, from the beginning. If we look at the organizers were not truckers. They were not part of the of that industry. They are people who have, you know, deep ties and a long history of affiliation with the far right. Some of them were actively involved in the Yellow Vest movement and the United We Roll convoy. But 3 years ago, which was also infiltrated by the far right. And so this is a sort of a different version of that. And it, you know, sort of on steroids, if you will. So it was a cabal, a group of individuals with a particular agenda who saw an opportunity here. Very, you know, I think you mentioned earlier on, right? They're very opportunistic. They saw an opportunity of a sector, an industry that's been affected by a particular mandate that they could use as leverage for fomenting all kinds of hysteria and anger and fear directed towards the tyrannical state. So it was a very careful manipulation of a particular industry. And so many of the truckers came, you know, without an awareness of what that agenda was. And they, you know, as time wore on, I think, you know, if you're exposed to ideas for a long enough and sharp enough period of time, you begin to embrace them yourself. And this is what we've seen, is sort of a hardening of a broadening and a hardening of the ideological currents associated with the far right.
So we had the brouhaha with the police chief slowly in Ottawa stood down. And I mean, there were mixed signals coming from some of the dispatches I was reading. One is that he was stabbed in the back because he was a Jamaican and a cop of color, and therefore, you know, that he'd been undermined continually. The other was that he was incompetent and this was all his fault and that he should go. What is the politics here? Is anything coming out?
Yeah, I'm happy to take an initial stab at that. I'm sure Dr. Perry will have some conclusions about it too. But as someone who's sitting on the ground and watches local politics very closely in this city, I think two things can be true at the same time. I think that is the case with Chief Slowly, that I think that it is no surprise that the only two resignations that have come so far in this entire process are from two men of color. Mm-hmm. Right. You've got the chief of police is gone and one of the members of the police services board who voluntarily resigned because out of disgust, quite frankly, with the way the process was going. Ralston King, one of our city councillors. We should not breeze over that. That is not a coincidence that this is the case. I think that it's also entirely possible to mount a very clear critique of Slowly's ability to lead this kind of crisis. There are many questions about whether or not he was the right sort of leader for this sort of moment. He was hired for one very particular purpose, which was to try and help transform the Ottawa Police Service and make it a more inclusive, broad-based organization. And he has not been here very long, so the amount of progress he could make on that was fairly limited to this stage. He's only been here 2 years. But there are a lot of questions about whether or not he had the depth of operational experience, on the ground experience, in the field experience, in order to be able to properly command respect and command the forces in a way that would leave them confident that the outcome was going to be what they expected it to be. And I think that those refrains are repeated far too much for us to ignore them. And I think that, so in this case, it is definitely at least two tales, but they should both be taken seriously.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, I mean, there's certainly not much I would add there, except to say that in the, you know, the communities I run with, in terms of the work that I generally do around hate crime, that you know, there was a lot of community enthusiasm and optimism when he was appointed, because they really did think he was going to be a change maker. And Ottawa Police Service is, you know, historically and notoriously, I think, a very conservative outfit. So, you know, I think there would be no surprise that there was resistance to those sorts of initiatives. So, but I wouldn't speculate beyond that. You know, I'm not privy to those conversations. But I think that balance that you talk about, Tim, is a very apt characterization.
Well, it comes a point that, I mean, I don't want to make apologies for him, I don't know him, but he might have wondered whether his troops would obey orders. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you see the entire New York Police Department turn their backs on the elected mayor, you wonder just who's running the country, whether it's the policeman's, whether in New York, it's the Patrolman's Benevolent Union, and the other places, Washington Post did a piece where the police regularly exonerate their own people when they're dismissed and let them out again. Now, it's an issue that we dealt with last year with a press conference on police unions and their pernicious effect on civic life with a sense of impunity. So was the Ottawa police force anything like that? Were there organized, well, formal or informal connections with the far right and the groups involved in the, I'm trying to pick the right word, in the occupation?
Well, I mean, I only have it from a couple of officers that I've known for some time, and a couple of current officers who sort of put it in terms of sympathy, that there is sympathy for those sorts of movements, and that there is, you know, sort of racism across the service. But they wouldn't go so far as to say that they're necessarily affiliated with any particular groups. So we'll leave it at that.
Mm-hmm. So what there are implications of this for the rest of the world, because Canada was such a not always accurately taken as an example of a smooth running democracy. And it's funny, all of this American money is coming into what in American terms is a Bolshevik state with socialistic healthcare and union rights and you know, self-proclaimed socialists in parliament. You know, this is Bolshevik.
If only it were true. if only it were true.
Well, yeah, it will be interesting as we begin to parse out those contributions and where they've come from. And, you know, we're sort of early days with that now that the data have been leaked in particular. I mean, it's really no surprise because, you know, the anti-mandate, the anti-restriction movement there is even broader and more vocal than it is here, much more intense than it is in this context. So no surprise that they're celebrating it and therefore supporting it, just as their former president has done, you know, supporting quite publicly the Freedom Convoy as well. So,
I'd have thought in the context of Canada, and you're really disillusioning me now, that a civilized place like Canada would take one look at a nouveau riche thug like Donald Trump and say, now, if he's endorsing it, it must be bad.
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the things that is beginning to sort of pull the gloss, take the sheen off the movement for a number of people is, you know, is the implicit and explicit support, but also I think the increasing evidence of the role of far right organizers here.
Yes,
one of the far right groups that turned up as a self-appointed spokesman, I'd like you to digress on it, is the separatist movement for the Western provinces.
Oh, well, actually,
absolutely.
I'm going to say, yeah, I mean, that's where it started, right? I mean, many of those organizers were part of the Wexit movement or part of the Maverick Party. And so there's absolutely a long history of Western alienation and separatist sentiment as well. That, you know, was, I think, one of the sparks for the original organizers. It's a way to, you know, sort of further embed that. But what's interesting, and Tim, you know, you probably have more to say on that, but and maybe you have some more to say on this as well. A journalist early on, you know, wanted to talk to me about some of the flags and emblems and things we were seeing, and indicated that one of the flags we were seeing was that of the FLQ, the Front de Libération de Québec, which was a left-wing separatist movement in the 60s and 70s here, and sort of our latest real kind of
most dramatic
organization. Yeah, let's put it that way, prior to, you know, what we've been seeing in recent years. And I thought that was very interesting. And you know, I haven't heard anything, I haven't really been able to track anything more down, whether that was someone exploiting that in sympathy with Western separatists, or whether it was, you know, young right-wingers not understanding that was a left-wing movement, or if it was, you know, the resurrection of a Quebec separatist movement, left or right. So that was kind of interesting.
Yeah,
so
I think
you've heard anything more about that.
Yeah, I have. So I think that what's interesting about this, and it goes back to a comment I made earlier, which is that this particular incident, if we can call it that for the moment, is becoming a large, capacious vessel for all of the various grievances that do exist and have existed within the Canadian Federation. It would be a mistake to pretend that this is entirely about mandates, which we've said before. This is part of a very much deeper, broader international movement that is very clearly aimed at the traditional institutions, methods, approaches of the liberal state. And I think that that cannot be underestimated. The number of American organizers, spokespeople, podcasters who come from that kind of tech, alt-right, anti-government, free the people, the number of absolute supporters of cryptocurrency that have descended on Ottawa in the last couple of weeks is quite shocking. So I think it is important to maintain this within a broader international context, which is appropriate for this venue because we're talking to people who are trying to combat this with a worldview, that what's happening in Canada is very much an arm of what is happening everywhere to some degree in Western democracies. And the avid interest, I mean, you don't have to spend much time on Twitter. If you just park on Twitter in the evening, you will see spaces popping up, discussion spaces popping up on Twitter that deal specifically with what's happening here. But the bulk of the people who populate those rooms are people who are based in the United States. And they are people who are discussing things like very long-standing conspiracies about New World Order, talking about, you know, the imposition of world rule from Davos on the various democracies of the world, the discussing of the importance of cryptocurrency to ensure that governments can't reach into people's pockets and exert their control. The amount of this kind of discussion that is circulating around the protest in Ottawa suggests that this is far more than just a simple grievance protest. This is reflective of a much bigger movement that we have a deep responsibility to get a handle on if we have any affection or hope for our, you know, democratic institutions. I was going to say parliamentary, but that doesn't apply everywhere. But if we have any attachment to broad-based, pluralistic, democratic approaches, we need to take this discontent very seriously, because people are putting their lives, their incomes, their property on the line to make a statement that is profoundly incoherent. And we need to ask ourselves why that is. Why are people willing to risk everything for something that cannot be clearly articulated? There's clearly a lot of rage there.
It sounds like the revolutionary meeting in Monty Python's Life of Brian, where they're trying to discuss what the aims are.
Yes, exactly.
What are these mandates ever done for us? But Jonathan
Kapke. And that could well be its downfall as well, right? Because we've seen this in the far right. We've seen it in the left for, you know, decades, but in the far right, you do see that it sort of devolves into pissing contests and, you know, battles for control, internal control of the movement. So that could well be its downfall.
It's also like the White Queen. I mean, she could believe three impossible things before breakfast. And these people have ideas in a state of quantum superposition. The government is too powerful. The government is not doing anything. The government is X, the government is Y, all at the same time. And what Jonathan Kapstein has said, it picks up on an issue. You haven't mentioned French Canada. We've seen several of the protesters there. Some of the noisiest and smelliest trucks, from what I could see, were emblazoned with French slogans. And, you know, as you said, I mean, the Quebecois sort of tend to be more social democratic than the rest of Canada. They believe in social welfare. They have relaxed immigration for people who speak French and other issues like this. How are they integrating this? Or is this something that's calculated to alienate them from the Federation even more than they already are?
Well, I think there are a number of things going on. I mean, the far right in particular in the Quebec context is very different elements of it are very different than what we see elsewhere, and they're much more closely tied to European French far right in terms of, you know, staunch resistance to contemporary immigration patterns, in particular those that allow Muslims into the country. And that's embedded in their politics. It's embedded in policy now around the laïcité legislation, which bars symbols of symbols of religious faith in public employment. So teachers, for example, and civil, what's the word I'm looking for?
So that's another case of beware what you ask for, because the people who did this were profoundly anti-Muslim and then discovered if you ban religious symbols, that includes crucifixes and stars of David and daggers and all sorts of other things that you hadn't really thought about in your monomaniac hatred of one.
Yeah. And I want to pick up on something that Dr. Perry has said, and neither one of us is Francophone, which is extremely important to point out. Neither one of us is from Quebec, I assume. But an important thread to this and a very strong difference between these currents coming out of Quebec versus the rest of Canada is that within Quebec, there is a much stronger sense of cultural nationalism, that a lot of the sentiment that drives this kind of discontent comes from that strong central identity discussion versus what's happening in the rest of the country, which is much more run of the mill, anti-government, small government kinds of conversations. And so while there are synergies between those two sorts of movements, you know, they're pissed off with the federal government, great, let's get in there and join that. It is not necessarily indicative of a common purpose. That they have common grievance, but probably quite widely divergent ends that they are attempting to meet. And I think that's very important to keep in mind. The fact of French Canada must always be factored into discussions about our national politics, because it is a dynamic that exists on a different plane. It intersects the main conversation at a different angle. And so while you can find commonalities, the attempt to try and make it synchronize completely with what's going on in the rest of the country is usually a mistake.
So are there any other protesters likely to come up from, you know, from the West or from the indigenous peoples and say, hey, you know, if there's chaos, we may as well make some hay?
Well, I mean, the Western separatists are there. I mean, they're already at the table. There are those saying, well, you know, this is clearly not a far right protest because there are Indigenous people involved. There are BIPOC people involved. But as Tim was saying, you know, they're coming with that one thread that they share that binds them, that is anti-statism, but they're coming at that from very different perspectives and for very different reasons. That is, you know, some are more deeply rooted in history than others as well, you know, as a settler colonial state, you know, that has affected both Indigenous and racialized communities here, you know, very good reason to distrust the state. And to be hostile towards the state, but again, comes from a very different place.
Tim?
Yeah, I think I've said my piece for the most part on that, except to say that I think that one of the glories and challenges of Canada is the incredibly diverse cultural backgrounds of its different regions. And there is no clear, strong, powerful, unifying narrative in Canada the way that there is, for example, in the United States. It is much more gentle and much more unassuming on the surface, but that does not mean that it is not powerful and ever present, that Canada is the nation that has typically swept its extremely difficult issues under extraordinarily tidy rugs. That we have had a history of conflict, we have had a history of marginalizing groups, we've had a history of making all kinds of identities and actions illegal historically, but we tend to tidy it up and tend not to make it a part of our national story. And so, for example, I teach Canadian political history from time to time, and I am no longer surprised at how little the average Canadian university student actually understands about the history of their country. In terms of the breadth of it, the nature of the conflicts that have occurred, the compromises and conflicts that happened to create the society that we have now, and the peoples and cultures and languages that have been left by the side of the road along the way in order to arrive where we are now. And I think that, well, that is one of the richnesses of Canadian history. It is also an incredible and present danger, because there are lots of unaddressed legitimate grievances that exist within our body politic that an event and a moment like this tend to bring to the surface and provide a sense of common cause for those sorts of grievances. And basically, we better get our listening hats on, because otherwise we're going to find ourselves mired in this for years to come.
Well, at the beginning, we mentioned the possibility of a radioactive flash on the horizon here, emanating originally from Ukraine. We're looking at, Putin does seem to have a puckish element. He has people deliberately just staring up things at random almost across the world, it would appear, with the cyber attacks and others and the various wars, with no particular end, just out of chaos, opportunity will come, perhaps. Look, Canada, as Sarah Palin pointed out in obscurely, is very close to Russia. No one's made a claim that it used to all be part of the Russian Empire and they want to come back.
I don't know. Tim, are you hearing anything about the role of Russian influence here? I'm certainly not picking up on that.
Yes, a little bit. I have quite a few friends who work in disinformation. My main academic area is in the effects of political communication on people's decision-making processes. So that tends to plug into that entire universe of disinformation quite broadly. That crowd tends to be very cautious about drawing immediate conclusions. But I think that it would be fair to represent that position on the whole as saying that there is no question that there is an effect of foreign disinformation on the information environment. The question is, how deliberate is it? And how much of it is simply just a byproduct of general mischievousness? You know, an attempt to destabilize conversations in various places around the world with no particular aim in mind other than destabilizing the conversation. And so I think that that question is certainly wide open, and that there are a lot of people looking into that, of course. But it would be foolish to dismiss the instances where very clear, identified foreign propaganda has been used to weaponize conversations in Canada, in the West, in the United States. It would be foolish to dismiss those completely, because it's very clear that there are resources being applied to amplifying various sorts of conversations and discontents. And some of that money is coming from foreign powers to amplify those conversations. And I think that we can certainly say that. The question of how directed it is a whole other conversation.
It also comes back to what we were alluding to earlier about the about just staring it up for the sake of it. What they're doing, in effect, the right has fully appropriated and owned the left's old tactics. This is Abby Hoffman and the Yippies. This is a whole sort of series of left-wing and libertarian protests whose, to some extent, ethos and methodology has been hijacked by the right. And it should be disturbing to some people. Tim, you're waving your finger?
Yeah, I'm saying, because you've asked a question that gets at the core of this for me. And I mean, I am thoroughly biased because I'm a scholar of democratic theory and its practical implications. And so for me, I think that one of the ways to parse out those two movements, you can look at the tactics and say, these are time-honored and true tactics within democratic societies. Protest is central to democracy. Disagreement is absolutely fundamental to democracy. But I think the way in which we can pull these apart and parse them is by looking at What are the end goals? Are the protesters attempting to improve, enhance, advance our pluralistic conversation? And I would argue that people who are coming from, for example, a Black Lives Matter perspective are absolutely attempting to broaden the conversation. They're attempting to bring an entire disenfranchised people into the conversation and give them some standing and authority within it. With a protest like the one we're seeing at the moment, I'm sure an argument could be made that that's precisely what some of these people are doing. But I think you have to look at what are the unifying causes? Who are the leaders who are bringing this on? What are the narratives that are driving the animation of this? And for the most part, they are narratives of disintegration. They are narratives of pulling apart. They are narratives of rejection. And I think that we need to get a little more serious about getting down to the motives and getting down to the morality and getting down to the theory, you know, the ideas, the ideology that drives these things. Because I think if we don't do that, we are at risk of categorizing all discontent as a problem, which is precisely where we don't want to end up, because democracies don't function if there aren't, you know, really solid aggressive disagreements frequently. We only work our problems out if we put those problems on the table and argue them out. And if we start to disqualify some of the tactics that are involved in doing that, we're going to be in serious trouble. But that means we have to get more serious about parsing them out and understanding the roots of these conflicts and the intentions and sincerity of the people participating in them.
Yeah. And there, I mean, distinguish them as, you know, sort of a reactionary libertarian movement as opposed to a sort of progressive social justice movement. And I think the other piece is also, you know, talking about the end game, but also the strategies is, and the strategies in particular. I mean, you know, violence and threats of violence are born in the blood of the far right, and much less so in contemporary left politics. Anyway, to what extent we have left politics remaining in the Canadian
Well, that was one of the points that was, I'm finishing now, so I'm going to usurp my presidential right. It strikes me there's a convergence, because the key issue here is collective, solidaristic action versus individualism. Most of us say it is fair to say we have to have vaccines and masks to protect the society as a whole.
Yeah.
And the attitude coming straight from Ronald Reagan's 1970s is, up yours, I don't care about you, it's me. There is no such thing as people. It's me and family, said Margaret Thatcher. And we're really seeing on the streets of Ottawa this outright ideological conflict. Yeah. I throw it for you.
Well, I often say that you know, there are some folks out there who were absent the day in civics classes that they talked about the social contract, and you know, the need to sacrifice some of our freedom for more freedom for all. And I think that that's something that, yeah, I mean, it's you know, that strong neoliberal thread that is wound through contemporary society. I think it's time to revisit that. I mean, and that, maybe that's why it's been slow to come to the Canadian context, is because we've always understood ourselves to some extent to be more communitarian than the US. For
you have guns, but you don't shoot each other.
That's, yeah, more collective. Because collective rights are, you know, are embedded in our charter, which is, you know, not the case in the US. They're individual rights, not collective rights. So I think that's one of the buffers, one of the things that's protected us.
Well, I was going to highlight that too.
Okay, we consider it highlighted. The time is up. I've got to exercise my presidential authority. I've actually got a gavel somewhere here. Thank you very much. I think we've covered a lot of issues which haven't, as far as I've seen, been raised in general in the American press, which either assumes that you know, everybody knows about Canada, or just gives up. They don't know about it, so they carry on and just treat it as a subset of, you know, Nevada North sort of thing. So I'd like to thank you both for a formative and reasonable discussion. Nobody shouted, nobody threw a brick at us. This is Ian Williams, president of the Foreign Press Association in New York. We've had this fascinating conversation with Barbara Perry and Tim Mabry about what's happening. So what can I say? Please join the Foreign Press Association, sign up for our future events, help us finance more of this as we navigate through the the plague desert. And we will be back with more and more from north of the border at some point soon. We might even want to talk about the health service there, the terrible worst health service in the world. If you listen to somebody who's going to bill me $50,000 for an operation down the road. Thank you very much, everybody. Good luck, and we'll see you soon.